Pacifica Network. This is Democracy Now!
Since Al-Qaeda is not a country, they could not sign the treaty. So it makes perfect, nor would they, and we all know that. So it makes perfect sense to conclude that the president is not legally required to apply the Geneva Conventions to Al-Qaeda.
We send our men and women in the armed services into battle to stop torture in other countries, not to participate in it themselves. These values did not change or become less relevant after 9/11. Americans did not resolve to set aside our values or the Constitution after those vicious attacks. We didn't decide as a nation to stoop to the level of the terrorists.
The Senate continues debate on the confirmation of Roberto Gonzalez as Attorney General. We'll play excerpts from the floor and examine what has not been talked about, Gonzalez's role in facilitating the execution of prisoners as counsel to George Bush as governor of Texas. And we'll host a debate on a new UN report on the Sudan.
An independent commission appointed by the UN has found the Sudanese government and its Janjaweed auxiliaries guilty of grave crimes, probably crimes against humanity, although maybe not genocide. It calls for the Security Council to refer the case to the International Criminal Court, something the United States does not like.
Time the United Nations has failed African victims of a genocide, just like 10 years ago in Rwanda. The UN is now splitting hairs and showing the political cowardice, unwilling to define government intent in Sudan.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid warned President Bush that Democrats now have enough votes to block passage of Bush's plan to privatize Social Security. Reid said, quote, President Bush should forget about privatizing Social Security. It will not happen. The sooner he comes to that realization, the better off we are. Reid said none of the 44 Democrats in the Senate would back a plan that divert Social Security taxes into accounts that workers would invest in stocks and bonds. Reid's comments come as President Bush is preparing to deliver his State of the Union address tonight, a key piece of the speech, the privatization of Social Security. On Thursday, Bush will head off on a five-state campaign-style tour advocating for it. Some Democrats, though, are emerging to back the privatization of Social Security. Former Senator Bob Kerry, now president of New School University, published a prominent piece in the Wall Street Journal Tuesday calling for just that. Also today on Capitol Hill, Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee will begin its questioning of Michael Chertoff, President Bush's nominee to head the Department of Homeland Security. Chertoff is a federal judge who worked under John Ashcroft in the Justice Department after September 11th. He led the government's move to jail hundreds of Muslim and Arab men without pressing charges. He was also a chief architect of the USA Patriot Act. The American Civil Liberties Union has criticized Chertoff, saying, quote, he has an alarming record of pushing and in some cases breaching what is permissible under the Bill of Rights in the name of national security. The White House is hoping Chertoff will be easily confirmed. In 2003, Chertoff was confirmed to a federal judgeship by an 88-1 vote. Chertoff's hearing comes as the Washington Post is running a major piece today on the Department of Homeland Security, charging the department's effectiveness in protecting the country is being, quote, hampered by personality conflicts, bureaucratic bottlenecks, and an atmosphere of demoralization. Meanwhile, the full Senate's expected to vote on Attorney General nominee Alberto Gonzalez later this week. It now appears at least 30 Democratic senators, including Minority Leader Harry Reid, will oppose him. We'll play excerpts from the floor debate later in the program. Outgoing Attorney General John Ashcroft defended his work Tuesday, argued that aggressive law enforcement and intelligence gathering were, quote, expansions of freedom that helped prevent attacks on the United States. Ashcroft said one of his biggest mistakes was not to properly explain the USA Patriot Act to the public. Ashcroft also stood by some of his most controversial statements of the past 4 years, including his attacks on critics. In December 2001, he testified before the Senate saying, quote, "To those who scare peace-loving people with phantoms of lost liberty, my message is this. Your tactics only aid terrorists, for they erode our national unity and diminish our resolve." Ashcroft defended his comment on Tuesday, saying, quote, "I stand by my statement that people who do that divert us." In Iraq, some problems with Sunday's elections have emerged. Ballots reportedly never arrived in some Kurdish, disenfranchising up to 200,000 Kurdish Christians. In addition, some Sunnis have complained that polling places never opened in their areas. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has named former President Bill Clinton to be the United Nations Special Envoy for tsunami relief, as well as to deal with the conflicts in both Sri Lanka and Aceh. In Colombia, at least 14 soldiers died after a military post came under rocket attack. It's believed to be the deadliest attack carried out by anti-government rebels in 2 years. On Capitol Hill, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has asked the Energy Department to restore funding to the Pentagon to continue researching new nuclear bunker busters. This comes as the Financial Times reports the Bush administration had promoted several officials known as nuclear hawks for their hardline stance on nuclear weapons and arms control. A soldier who won a Purple Heart last year for his service in Iraq has fled to Canada rather than return to his Army unit. Darrell Anderson of Lexington, Kentucky, arrived in Toronto in January, now faces possible desertion charges and a prison term. He's hoping Canada will grant him refugee status. Anderson won his Purple Heart after being injured by a roadside bomb in Iraq last year. Anderson said, quote, "I can't go back to this war. I don't want to kill innocent people." Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean's expected to become the next chair of the Democratic National Committee. His chief rival, Congressmember Martin Frost, bowed out Tuesday. The official vote for the position is set for February 12th. The winner will replace outgoing DNC chair Terry McAuliffe. Dean rose to prominence in 2003 when he ran for president on an anti-war platform. And a new study in the journal Health Affairs has found half of all personal bankruptcies in the United States are now caused by soaring medical bills. On the earth.
There's famine, lack of shelter, lack of sanitation, and lack of adequate supply.
There is no longer any agricultural production. 3 million people in need of food.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A new United Nations report on Sudan criticizes the government and its militia of systematically abusing and killing civilians in the country's western Darfur region. But the report concludes the Sudanese government did not pursue a policy of genocide. The report does say some individuals, including government officials, had acted with, quote, genocidal intent. Over the past 2 years, at least 70,000 people have been killed in Darfur, and more than 2 million people have been forced to become refugees. The 176-page report was prepared by a 5-member UN-appointed commission and delivered to the Security Council last week. It recommended the Security Council immediately refer the situation in Darfur to the International Criminal Court, the ICC, the world's first permanent war crimes tribunal. But the Bush administration strongly opposed to the court and could use its veto to block a referral. Washington's proposed a war crimes tribunal in Tanzania to prosecute atrocities committed in Darfur. The State Department concluded in September 2004 that genocide had occurred in Darfur. We're joined right now by two people. Solly Booker is on the line with us. He is Director of Africa Action in Washington, D.C. Edward Mortimer joins us in our studio here in New York. He's Director of Communications for the Office of the UN Secretary General, and we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's great to have you with us. Well, Edward Mortimer, let's begin with you. Can you explain what this report says?
Well, I think you did a rather good job, actually. As you say, it finds that the government and its Janjaweed auxiliaries are responsible for an appalling series of crimes against civilians in Darfur, ostensibly against the rebel movement, but in most cases there probably were no rebels anywhere near when these people were being raped, robbed, driven out of their homes, killed in a number of cases, as you say. And even when there were rebels, the use of force was totally disproportionate. So they say this probably amounts to war crimes and crimes against humanity. They were asked to say whether it constituted genocide. They say there is one item missing for that, which is it's not clear that the motivation was to destroy an ethnic group. It does appear that the government was basically concerned to clear out the area where these rebels might find support, although, as you mentioned, it does say that individual government officials may have had genocidal intent, but it says that could only be established on a case-by-case basis by a competent court. They've established a list of the people they believe to be responsible for these crimes, and they have given that in a sealed file to the Secretary-General with a request that it only be turned over to a competent prosecutor. And as you said, the body that they think would be competent to conduct such trials and prosecutions is the International Criminal Court. So the ball is, so to speak, now in the court of the Security Council. They have the power under the statute of the court to refer any case to it, and they will have to decide whether that is the right thing to do.
Well, I want to go to the issue of the International Criminal Court after, but first get response from Solly Booker of Africa Action to this report.
Well, we have to reject the conclusion of the report with regard to the issue of genocide. This is the weakest and almost bizarre part of the report, because they're finding that there's no government policy of genocide is literally based on three anecdotal examples that they list in the report that have nothing to do with governmental intent. In a way, they're hiding behind this issue because, of course, intent is often the most difficult item to prove. A genocide is constituted of two elements, the mental element, the intent to destroy in whole or in part a racial, national, ethnic, or religious group, and then the physical element, which are the actual acts of violence, the killing, the raping, the other sexual crimes, the destruction of home, property, livelihood, creating conditions designed to bring about the destruction in whole or in part of particular groups. Now, the report provides ample evidence of all the physical acts of genocide that have resulted in as many as 400,000 people being killed over the past 2 years, 2 million homeless, internally displaced, 200,000 across the border in Chad and refugee camps. And it continues. And the report acknowledges these atrocities continue throughout the period of the investigation. Just last week, there were more than 20 aerial bombardments of villages that the African Union Observer Mission on the ground has noted. In investigating one of these bombings, the African Union troops were fired upon. So this genocide continues. The report simply fails to acknowledge government intent, and the intent is clear in documentary evidence that's available. The report notes that the government refused to provide and refused to cooperate in providing documents that they had promised to provide regarding aircraft and helicopter engagement in Darfur, as well as other documents that Human Rights Watch, for example, has released that provide documentary evidence. But then there's also, legal precedence has it that you can infer intent through the general context or circumstances of the perpetration of these culpable acts when they're systematically directed against a group. And clearly for the last 2 years, the government has used genocide as a methodology of counterinsurgency. The report is mixing intent with motive, even though it claims to make a distinction, it fails to do so. And that's the biggest problem. Now, whether or not it is...
Let me get response from Edward Mortimer on that point.
Well, I really don't want to get into an argument with Sally about this, and I think almost we're falling into the trap of the Sudanese government if we do that. I mean, they started out trying to claim this report as some kind of victory because it doesn't say that they're guilty of genocide. But then I think once the full text of the report was published, they completely changed tack and started saying that it was unfair, biased, and so on and so forth. The report says clearly that the crimes that have been committed may be no less serious and heinous than genocide. It says, as Sally mentioned, that they are continuing and that they must be stopped, that it is urgent to take action. So let's focus on taking the action, and if we get, as I hope we will, if we get to a competent court and to drawing up indictments against these people, then I think it would be for the prosecutor to decide whether to include genocide in the indictment. But the main thing is to take action, to bring these people to justice, and to stop what is happening and is continuing to happen in Darfur right now.
Sally Booker.
Well, the problem with taking action is another weakness of the report. The only action they refer to is the referring this investigation and the issue of accountability to the International Criminal Court, which we fully support and oppose the Bush administration's opposition. The problem, however, is that does nothing to protect the civilians on the ground in Darfur who continue to die every day, numbers estimated between 10,000 to 30,000 per month. The report, in its first conclusion, says that the people in Darfur need to be protected. Yet it doesn't recommend a Chapter 7 mandate for an international intervention to protect civilians and enforce, not observe, enforce the ceasefire. The African Union troops on the ground acknowledge they are not enough, they don't have the right mandate, and the international community is just dumping this problem on the African Union, which doesn't have the capacity to solve it. And so again, the international community is not living up to its own obligations. And I would argue that this is in part because they refuse to recognize it's genocide. You know, yes, they're willing to say it's war crimes, crimes against humanity, but because they've set up this public perception that somehow this is a lesser evil, they're not moving for any kind of Security Council resolution calling for a new mandate and an expansion of the force to protect civilians.
Edward,
let's not dump this all on this commission. The fact is, there's plenty of things that could have been done, and some things have been done, without waiting for this report. The Commission was given specific terms of reference, and I think it has fulfilled those. Recommending military intervention or other ways of dealing with the thing, I think, was not within their competence. Governments in the Security Council have the responsibility to decide how to deal with this crisis. They had that responsibility yesterday, and I think they have it even more sharply today in the light of what the report says.
You know, over a year ago, the United Nations humanitarian coordinator for Sudan, Mukesh Kapila, said, and I quote, "The only difference between Rwanda and Darfur now is the numbers involved. This is more than just a conflict. It's an organized attempt to do away with a group of people." That was the UN's own humanitarian coordinator for Sudan a year ago. We're in agreement about the need for accountability. We're in agreement about the need to stop the violence and the atrocities. Where we differ is that this is genocide. That's why it's important that you call it what it is. Otherwise, there's no point in having an international convention on genocide. There's no point in saying never again, as we did at the 60th anniversary of the Holocaust or the 10th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. And this is why the UN finding has generated such headlines as Sudan exonerated of genocide, etc. Imagine if the commission had acknowledged that, in fact, genocide is taking place. The political and moral obligation and pressure on the UN to finally act and protect civilians would have been far greater. As it is now, they're only talking about a resolution of sanctions.
Edward Mortimer,
I think you're doing a poor job as an advocate for human rights. You're emphasizing the one point in this report that you don't like, and you were saying that these are the headlines, but you're contributing to those headlines. Why don't you emphasize the things that you do like, that you agree about, and surely the need for action is the most important point.
As human rights advocates, we have an obligation to acknowledge genocide when it's occurring. It is a unique crime against humanity.
Okay, let's say, but whether it's genocide or not, are you going to wait until we agree on whether it's genocide before you do anything about it? Wouldn't it be more sensible to get on with it?
Well, that is what we've been trying to
do. Okay, then let's not waste time on this argument.
Which the United Nations has failed to do. As I said, they've dumped this on the African Union. They've been unwilling to bring the necessary force to bear. They're only talking about sanctions.
Well, now we're talking about something which is urgent and immediate.
You've been talking about sanctions. The past three UN Security Council resolutions have been getting weaker and weaker. The last
right.
One
okay. Well, that's where you should be concentrating your fire, surely, on the members of the Security Council. I think we agree that more urgent action is needed by the Security Council. And, you know, that means putting pressure on the governments represented in the Security Council to do something.
We have to break, but we're going to come back with Edward Mortimer, Director of Communications for the Office of Secretary General Kofi Annan, and Sally Booker on the line with us from Washington. He heads up Africa Action in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the Sudan. Stay with us. Jiluka Gijimbeke from Mary Makeba's homeland. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 300 radio and television stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and affiliates, NPR stations, public access TV, and PBS stations, as well as both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as on Direct TV Channel 375. And we're video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. Also, our transcripts are there on our website, and we close caption for the deaf and hard of hearing. I'm Amy Goodman. We're having a debate on the report that's come out of the United Nations on the Sudan. Our guests are Edward Mortimer, Director of Communications, Office of Secretary General, and advisor to Kofi Annan, as well as Sally Booker. He is the head of Africa Action in Washington, D.C. I interrupted your response, Sally Booker.
Well, I was just saying that we have maintained the same position both before and after this report, that the priority has to be to protect the civilians in Darfur who are vulnerable, who are dying every day, who do not have access to adequate humanitarian relief because this genocide continues. And we'll continue to advocate for an appropriate international response, which is a Chapter 7 mandate to intervene, to protect these civilians, and to enforce a ceasefire. This is not the first time that the government of Sudan has used genocide as a methodology for counterinsurgency. This commission of the UN was a wonderful opportunity to educate the international community about the meaning of genocide and its uniqueness as a crime, and it simply failed in that regard. Having said that, certainly we support the effort of the report to push for accountability, to push this to the International Criminal Court, but we're extremely disappointed that this commission does not speak to the immediate issue of protecting civilians on the ground who are dying in huge numbers every day.
But Edward Mortimer.
Maybe I could just quote a view of another human rights activist, Leslie Lefko, a Darfur expert at Human Rights Watch, who is quoted in the New York Times this morning, saying, "I think the whole bickering over genocide or not aside, it is a very strong report. It unequivocally states that there have been crimes against humanity, war crimes and atrocities. The focus on genocide is really a red herring used by the government of Sudan and others to distract from the larger issue of what has happened in Darfur." So I really think that we should, for the moment, agree to differ on this point and focus on what should be done.
Well, on the point of the International Criminal Court, Can you talk about the UN's view on this and the US response?
Well, the International Criminal Court was set up by a conference in Rome in 1998, which was convened by the UN. Kofi Annan, the Secretary General, was present when the statute was adopted. He has consistently supported it, as the majority of member states of the United Nations have. However, it is not a UN tribunal. It is a distinct entity, and you have to adhere to the statute and ratify it to become a party. Sudan has signed it but has not ratified it. The United States signed it in the last hours of the Clinton administration but has not ratified it, and the Bush administration is strongly opposed to it.
Unsigned it.
Sort of, but you can't really do that. But it exists. It has a prosecutor. It has judges. It is taking up a number of cases, and I think we will soon, before very long, see trials in that court. It's, so to speak, ready to go. Whereas they are suggesting, you know, set up another ad hoc tribunal like the ones for Rwanda and former Yugoslavia, which are very expensive and would take a long time. However, the Secretary General has been careful to say this is not a decision for him. This is something the Security Council members have to work out among themselves. The important thing is that there should be an effective accountability mechanism, and whether it's the ICC or something else, let the Security Council decide.
Mm. Sally Booker, your response to this approach.
Well, we absolutely agree that it should be the ICC, that is what this court was established to achieve. We absolutely oppose the Bush administration's efforts, all-out efforts, I would say, to undermine the ICC and to propose some duplicative creation of some new court without even consultation with the African Union on this. I would just reiterate that accountability is absolutely important. The ICC is the way to go, but that does not in any way provide any protection to the people on the ground who continue to face the genocidal war of the government of Sudan.
On this issue of the International Criminal Court, although President Bush opposes it, saying that they don't want U.S. soldiers and U.S. officials to be held accountable in an International Criminal Court, it has been my impression that it's fine for them to hold others accountable in such a court. So what is the distinction between an ad hoc tribunal, sort of Rwanda-style tribunal in Tanzania, versus this?
Well, I think that their opposition to this particular court is visceral and ideological, and they basically have said, you know, even though we agree that in this case these people should be prosecuted, we don't want to do anything to give any legitimacy to that court. I think it's an unfortunate position, but that is their position, and the other members of the Security Council are going to have to find a way either to persuade them to come off it or work around it or reach a compromise with them. We'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully the other members of the Security Council will all agree that it should go to the ICC and force the U.S. in a position as to whether or not it's going to veto this resolution for accountability on these crimes in the Sudan. The problem, however, is China, which is the major investor in the oil industry in Sudan, and Russia, which is the major arms supplier to the government of Sudan, are unlikely to support any strong measures, whether sanctions or whether on the issue of accountability, directed against the government of Sudan.
So, Edward Mortimer, you now have a situation where the Bush administration has called what happened in Darfur genocide, and the United Nations is not going as far as that.
That's correct. I mean, obviously, the United States is a very important member of the United Nations, but it's not the only one. And clearly, there isn't a consensus on this point. But I think that shouldn't stop us from working, as has been said, to get effective joint action to stop and punish the very, very serious crimes that clearly are happening, whether they're genocide or not.
Not calling it genocide, does that mean that certain mechanisms of the UN are not triggered?
I think it only means that the Convention on Genocide, signed in 1948, is not triggered. But there are plenty of other mechanisms that can and should be triggered.
Mm-hmm. Like?
Well, the Security Council has primary responsibility under the Charter for international peace and security. I think it's by now pretty clearly understood that that means not only war between states, but civil war and massacres and violations of systematic violations of human rights happening within states. And when you talk about war crimes and crimes against humanity, certainly those states that are parties to the Rome Statute would say the International Criminal Court should be involved. So I think there is certainly scope for sanctions. That has already been discussed by the Council. The Secretary-General has said that it should still be on the table. It's been mentioned that the African Union does have a small number of troops on the ground. I think that clearly needs to be greatly beefed up, I think, both in terms of the numbers of the logistical resources and the mandate. They don't really have a protection mandate as things stand. They are more there as observers or to protect observers than they are to protect the population.
Are you concerned about a repeat of 10 years ago with Rwanda?
Well, obviously, everybody is concerned about that. Equally, obviously, no two situations are exactly alike. The appalling and terrifying thing about Rwanda was how quickly it all happened. You had close to 1 million people massacred in the space of less than 3 months. This is like a sort of crawling Rwanda. With the relatively small numbers of people being killed, driven from their homes, raped every day. But it has now been going on for about 2 years, and it is really shocking that it has not been stopped yet.
Hmm. And the people on the commission, who made up the commission?
Well, the commission was a commission essentially of jurists. The president of it, Antonio Cassese, very distinguished Italian judge, who was in fact the first president of the UN Special Tribunal on Crimes in the former Yugoslavia. And the others are drawn from different parts of the world. One of them is an Egyptian judge, Mohamed Fayek, so that's a neighbouring, normally friendly country to Sudan, fellow Muslim and Arab country. You've got Hina Jilani, who is from Pakistan, also a Muslim country. You've got Dumisa Ntsebeza, who I think is from South Africa. So it's an international body. I think it represents the collective wisdom of the jurists and human rights activists of the world.
Sally Booker, final word.
Well, I think the real issue is citizen action. The world is failing Sudan as it failed Rwanda 10 years ago. The difference will be, will citizens bring sufficient pressure to bear in this country and in other countries in the world to make sure that the Security Council acts differently this time around? And we would encourage people to visit our website, www.africaaction.org, to take actions to be part of this civil society movement to end the genocide in Darfur.
On that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Again, Edward Mortimer, Director of Communications, the Office of the Secretary General, advisor to Kofi Annan, and Sally Booker of Africa Action in Washington, D.C. As we turn now to Alberto Gonzalez, the full Senate continues debate today on the confirmation of Gonzalez as Attorney General. During 8 hours on the floor Wednesday, some Senate Democrats sharply criticized Gonzalez's role in laying the legal groundwork that led to the torture of detainees at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted 10-8 along party lines last week to endorse Gonzalez. The close vote prompted speculation that Democrats might seek to block a vote on the Senate floor through a filibuster. But leading Democrats indicated this week that that's unlikely, instead extending debate until at least Thursday. It now appears at least 30 Democratic senators, including the minority leader Harry Reid, will vote against Gonzalez's confirmation. Meanwhile, Republican senators took to the floor to defend Gonzalez's record as White House counsel. Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah was among his staunchest supporters. This is an excerpt of what Senator Hatch had to say.
Some of my colleagues are trying to unfairly blame Judge Gonzalez for abuses committed by renegade soldiers at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. But Judge Gonzalez, of course, was not in charge of the soldiers in the field. He was not the person telling soldiers what interrogation techniques they could or could not use. I, like the president, like Judge Gonzalez, and like many of the American public, was sickened by the abuses that occurred at Abu Ghraib prison. But these violations are not going unpunished. I talked about the investigations, prosecutions, and convictions that the Defense Department has undertaken with respect to those perpetrators, and how despicable those perpetrators are. I know that we will see more prosecutions and convictions as time goes on. The Defense Department has been active on this and acted immediately and has been acting ever since. It may not be published in the front pages of the newspapers, and you may not hear about it on the 6 o'clock news, but these people are going to be brought to justice for their wrongdoing. And to blame Judge Gonzalez for this is just making him a scapegoat. And that's wrong. Well, that is not the only thing my colleagues are trying to unfairly blame Judge Gonzalez for. They are trying to blame him for the so-called Bybee memo, a memo that Judge Gonzalez did not write, a memo that was written by an agency, the Department of Justice, that Judge Gonzalez did not work in, an agency over which Judge Gonzalez was not responsible. And there's been an implication here that he, as White House counsel, should have reversed everything and just told the Justice Department what to do. Now, if he'd done that, my gosh, he'd be criticized for that. Fact of the matter is that the Justice Department is the advisory body on these type of legal issues for the executive branch of government. He may be White House counsel, but that doesn't give him the right to change any opinion given by the Justice Department. And I brought out that on February 7th, before the Bybee memo was brought forth, on February 7th of the same year, the president did sign a memorandum with regard to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda that basically said that although these prisoners do not qualify for Geneva Convention protections, they should be treated humanely. You don't hear a lot about that memorandum. And if you do, I'll probably distort that. Now, I'd like to spend a few minutes to focus specifically on the Geneva Conventions. There has been a lot of discussion and, frankly, a lot of misinformation that I would like to take a few moments to clarify. Now, some of the legal principles involved might sound a little complicated, but I will try to explain this as simply as I can. The Geneva Conventions are an international treaty. One key question facing the United States as we fought back against the terrorists was whether Iraq, the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda should be treated differently under this treaty. First, as we all know, treaties are signed by countries. They are not signed by individuals, foreign individuals. Iraq signed the Geneva Conventions. There has never been any question that the Geneva Conventions apply to our conflict in Iraq, where Abu Ghraib is located. Afghanistan also signed the Geneva Conventions. Afghanistan, however, has been embroiled in internal violent conflicts for 22 years. There was no legally recognized leader, no legally recognized central government, and for that matter, there were not even basic government services in the country at that time, or in that country, meaning Afghanistan at that time. The Taliban is one of these violent factions, but they did not control the entire country. There was a question about whether Afghanistan was a failed state as a matter of international law. If it was a failed state, then the treaty naturally would not apply to them. Ultimately, the president decided that regardless of what the law requires, he was going to apply the Geneva Conventions to the Taliban. That is what it says in the president's February 7, 2002 memorandum. Going to the third category, Al-Qaeda is not a country. They are not a faction within a single country. They are a group of individuals from lots of different places who go around the world spreading terror and murdering innocent people. Simply put, they are a gang of terrorists, not a country. Since Al-Qaeda is not a country, they could not sign the treaty. So it makes perfect, nor would they, and we all know that. So it makes perfect sense to conclude that the president is not legally required to apply the Geneva Conventions to Al-Qaeda. So far, the analysis has been pretty straightforward. You sign the treaty applies to you. The next step is a little more complicated. Under the Geneva Conventions, all detainees are not treated alike. In order to receive preferential treatment as a detainee, you must qualify as a POW, a prisoner of war. In order to be considered a prisoner of war, the group must have an organized command structure, uniforms or insignia, openly carrying arms and obeying the laws of war. Al-Qaeda and the Taliban detainees cannot qualify as POWs. Neither Al-Qaeda nor the Taliban have a permanent centralized communications infrastructure the way you would expect to find such in a typical military organization. The Taliban is a loose array of individuals with shifting loyalties among various Taliban and Al-Qaeda figures. Defections and bribery are rampant. Second, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda members wear no uniform or other insignia that serve as, quote, fixed sign recognizable at a distance, unquote. They dress like civilians in that area of the world. Third, although the Taliban carry arms openly, so do many in Afghanistan. They do not attempt to distinguish themselves from others carrying weapons. Lastly, fourth, the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban do not follow the laws of war. We are all too familiar on how Al-Qaeda operates since we saw their despicable handiwork on September 11, 2001. They dress as civilians. They specifically attack civilians after hijacking civilian commercial airlines. They transform civilian aircraft into a weapon of destruction to murder thousands of ordinary, innocent human beings. The Taliban use mosques for ammunition storage and for command and control meetings. They put tanks and artillery in close proximity to hospitals, schools, and residences. The Taliban has massacred hundreds of Afghan civilians, raped women, and pillaged villages.
Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, Republican, on the floor of the Senate defending Alberto Gonzalez to be confirmed as Attorney General. When we come back, we'll hear a response from Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy and then a discussion about Alberto Gonzalez's role as counsel to Governor George Bush in Texas on the death penalty. Stay with us.
There's a pale horse coming, and I'm gonna ride it. I'll rise in the morning, my fate decided, I'm a dead man walking, I'm a dead man walking. In St. James Parish, I was born and christened, now I've got my story. Mister, ain't no need for you to listen. It's just a dead man talking. Once I had a job, I had a good. But between our dreams and actions lies this world. In the deep fiery, their blood and tears rushed over me. All I could feel was the drugs and the shotgun and my fear up inside of me, like a dead man talking. Beneath the summer sky, my eyes went black.
Dead Man Walking, Bruce Springsteen, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to the Democratic response, or at least Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy's response on the confirmation of Alberto Gonzalez as Attorney General.
Mr. President, this is one of the most important votes the Senate will take this year. The issue raised by Mr. Gonzalez's nomination go to the heart of what America stands for in the world and the fundamental values that define us as a nation, our commitments to individual dignity, our respect for the rule of law, and our reputation around the world as a beacon for human rights, not as a violator of human rights. President Bush said it well in his inaugural address last month. From the day of our founding, we have proclaimed that every man and woman on this earth has rights and dignity and matchless value because they bear the image of the maker of heaven and earth. The world is watching to see if our actions match our rhetoric. How can the Senate possibly approve the nomination of Mr. Gonzalez as Attorney General of the United States, the official who symbolizes our respect for the rule of law, when Mr. Gonzalez is the official in the Bush administration who, as the White House counsel, advised the president that torture was an acceptable method of interrogation in Afghanistan, Guantanamo, and Iraq? Torture is contrary to all that we stand for as Americans. It violates our basic values. It's alien to our military's longstanding rules and tradition. We send our men and women in the armed services into battle to stop torture in other countries, not to participate in it themselves. These values did not change or become less relevant after 9/11. Americans did not resolve to set aside our values or the Constitution after those vicious attacks. We didn't decide as a nation to stoop to the level of the terrorists. To the contrary, Americans have been united in their belief that an essential part of winning the war on terrorism and protecting the country for the future is safeguarding the ideals and the values that America stands for here at home and around the world. Americans agree that torture is and should remain beyond the pale. A recent poll in USA Today showed that Americans strongly disapprove of the interrogation tactics that have been used in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo, including the use of painful stress positions, sexual humiliation, threatening prisoners with dogs, threatening to ship them to countries known to practice torture. The American public has held fast to our most basic fundamental values, and how could our government have gone so wrong? But Mr. Gonzalez is at the center of a torture policy that has run roughshod over the values that Americans hold so dear. On issue after issue in developing this policy, he has endorsed expediency over the rule of law. He adopted an absurdly narrow definition of torture in order to permit extreme interrogation practices. He advocated an unjustifiably expansive view of president power, purporting to put the executive branch above the law. He ignored the plain language of the Geneva Conventions in an attempt to immunize those who may commit war crimes. He continues to push a discredited interpretation of our treaty obligations to permit the CIA to commit cruel, inhuman, and degrading acts outside of the United States. He refuses to be candid about his interpretations, policies, and intentions. The administration's policy on torture was established in August of 2002 in a Justice Department document called the Bybee, or more accurately, the Bybee-Gonzalez Memorandum. The memorandum was written at Mr. Gonzalez's request. It reads, Memorandum for Alberto Gonzalez, Counsel to the President. The first two sentences read, you have asked for our office's views regarding the standards of conduct under the Convention Against Torture and the anti-torture statute passed by Congress in 1994. As we understand it, this question has arisen in the context of the conduct of interrogations outside the United States. After its release in August 2002, the memorandum became the official policy on interrogations by the Defense Department and the CIA for 2.5 years, until it was repudiated just last month at the last minute on the eve of Mr. Gonzalez's nomination. Yet Mr. Gonzalez refuses to tell us anything about how the Bybee-Gonzalez memorandum was written and why he ordered it. We know from press accounts that the CIA asked him for advice on how far the agency could go in interrogating detainees. In July of 2002, he held meetings with other administration officials to discuss how to legally justify certain interrogation methods. He refuses to tell us anything about those meetings. He says he can't remember what specific interrogation methods were discussed. He can't remember who asked for the Justice Department's legal advice in the first place. He can't remember whether he made any suggestions to the department on the drafting of the Bybee-Gonzalez memoranda, although he admits it would not be unusual for his office to have done so. He doesn't know how the memoranda was forwarded to the Defense Department and became part of the working group report in April of 2003, which was used to justify the new interrogation practices at Guantanamo. Those practices, in turn, to use the obscure word resorted to by the administration, somehow migrated to U.S. military operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, as if no human hand had been involved in the dissemination. Torture became a pervasive practice. The FBI says so. The Red Cross says so. The Defense Intelligence Agency says so. The Defense Department says it has investigated more than 300 cases of detainee torture, sexual assault, and other abuse. Additional allegations of abuse, many of them too sickening to be described in open session on the floor of the Senate, are reported almost daily. Yet Mr. Gonzalez cannot remember the details of how any of it happened. The Judiciary Committee has repeatedly asked Mr. Gonzalez to provide the documents on his meetings, valuations, and decisions on the Bybee Memorandum. These documents would speak volumes about all the issues Mr. Gonzalez says he has trouble remembering. Yet he refuses to provide the documents. He won't even search for them. In his response to our written questions, Mr. Gonzalez stated 8 times that he has not conducted a search for the requested documents. In other words, the documents we want may exist, but he's not going to look for them. It's hard to imagine a more arrogant insult to the constitutional role of the Senate in considering nominations. I have here, Mr. President, the letters, the questions that I had submitted that filed back on January 18th. Did you participate in meetings with specific interrogation techniques were discussed? I'll include the full answer, but include it in the answer. For me to provide details about the methods of questioning terrorists mentioned in meetings that I attended would entail discussing classified information, and I'm not at liberty to do so. Could you tell the positions taken by the individuals present at the meetings when these topics were discussed? Any meeting of the type you described, any records reflecting the information you specified, would involve pre-decisional deliberations. Pre-decisional deliberations. And I'm not at liberty to disclose. What is pre-decisional deliberations? Is that executive privilege? If so, why don't they say it? If it's not, he has a requirement. And the committee shouldn't have passed him out unless he's going to answer the questions.
Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy, Democrat, on the floor of the Senate. Today, the debate over the confirmation of Alberto Gonzalez continues. While Alberto Gonzalez's role in laying the legal groundwork for the torture of detainees did take center stage in yesterday's Senate debate, his time as Bush's gubernatorial counsel during his days as Texas governor has not been the subject of debate. At that time, one of Alberto Gonzalez's most important jobs was to brief Governor Bush on each execution in the state. During Bush's 6 years as governor, there were 157 executions. For the first 57 of those cases, Gonzalez wrote a briefing, an execution summary, for Bush to review. Journalist Alan Berlow obtained the memos and wrote about them extensively in the Atlantic Monthly in the summer of 2003. Berlow concluded Gonzalez, quote, repeatedly failed to apprise the governor of crucial issues in the cases at hand, ineffective counsel, conflict of interest, mitigating evidence, even actual evidence of innocence. He now has a piece at Salon.com on this issue. Alan Berlow is a Washington-based freelance journalist. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you summarize for us Alberto Gonzalez's role as counsel to Governor Bush on this issue?
Well, during the time that Bush was governor, as you pointed out, there were 152 executions. Bush granted clemency in one case. And if you go through the archive of the Texas State Archive, which has the Bush gubernatorial records, you'll see that in terms of the volume of correspondence, virtually 12%, I believe, of the correspondence coming in and out of that office concerned executions. There were executions as many as two a week, as many as eight a month. So this was a major issue during Bush's governorship, possibly the most widely reported issue. Now, Gonzalez, who handled the first 57 of those executions up through the execution of Carla Faye Tucker, was responsible for presenting a briefing to Bush. These typically took place on the morning of the execution. They lasted no more than 30 minutes. In addition to the oral briefing, Gonzalez provided a written summary, which ran anywhere from 3 to 7 pages. And as the article you mentioned points out, very often Gonzalez left out of those memoranda the most important evidence pertaining to clemency. In fact, I found no evidence that Gonzalez transmitted a single clemency petition to Bush in any of the 57 cases that he handled. A clemency petition sets forward the most the strongest case on the defendant's behalf for some sort of commutation. Gonzalez never saw fit to transmit one of those to Bush.
Can you share some examples with us, specific cases, Alan Berlow?
Well, I think the case of David Wayne Stoker might be one of the more interesting. And as I describe it, I think it would be worth putting yourself in the position of a senator who has to pass on the confirmation of Gonzalez and ask yourself as a senator, would you vote to execute David Wayne Stoker based on this information? Now, Gonzalez wrote an 18-sentence summary of the case. Stoker was convicted, sentenced to die for murdering a convenience store clerk by the name of David Manrique in 1986 in a robbery that netted, I think, $86 or something along those lines. Gonzalez's 18-sentence summary left out a huge amount of information. He doesn't mention that a federal appellate judge concluded that the state's star witness against Stoker was just as likely the murderer. He didn't note that a key state witness recanted his testimony following Stoker's conviction. That witness explained that he'd been pressured by the prosecution to perjure himself. He also doesn't mention that the state star witness received a financial reward for fingering Stoker and had felony drug and weapons charges dropped the day he testified against Stoker. In addition, Gonzalez didn't mention that two police witnesses lied under oath at trial. The state's expert medical witness had pleaded guilty to 7 felonies involving falsified evidence in capital murder trials. And the state's psychiatric witness, the notorious Dr. James Grigson, widely known as Dr. Death, had been expelled from the American Psychiatric Association for providing unethical testimony in murder cases prior to this clemency petition coming before Bush. So Bush gets this clemency case on the eve of the execution of Stoker.
We have 18, 10 seconds.
18 sentences. All of this information is left out, and Bush, as was his wont, simply checks the deny clemency box on the form.
Alan Berlow, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Latest piece at Salon.com. That does it for today's program. You can go to our website for transcripts to hear or see the program at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, and a very special welcome to Yoruba Richin. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!